Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on mind control and world control right after this. The income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. And these programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing, and Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters. In violation of Matthew 6, verse 24, the income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. And the income tax requires that we use unjust weights and balances, which is a violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And this income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods, called governments, in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, and Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed, and then we're taught to call that income redistribution. But the Scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, the Creator of the universe gave us a better way of life than that, and our Founding Fathers followed that better way. That's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice a better way of life than income tax and Social Security. Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you just call the law school, 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967 to order your free copy. Tax and Status is also available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, just go to the website, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's George Gordon. .org or call direct 417-273-4967. Alright, talking about mind control. Mind control has been an experimental project of our military and our intelligence establishment at least since the 1930s. Let me give you some of the experiments that have been done on the public at large. The experiments on the public at large are going on right now today. I showed you that in previous programs, but in 1951, the Department of Defense began their air tests using disease-producing bacteria and viruses. These tests lasted through 1969, and there is concern that people in the surrounding areas have been exposed. In 1950, the Department of Defense began plans to detonate nuclear weapons in desert areas and then monitor downwind residents for medical problems and mortality rates. In 1953, the military released clouds of zinc-cadmium sulfide gas over Winnipeg, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Fort Wayne, and Mono Casey River Valley in Maryland and Leesburg, Virginia. Their intent was to determine how efficiently they could disperse chemical agents. In 1953, the Joint Army-Navy-CIA experiments are conducted in which tens of thousands of people in New York and San Francisco were exposed to the airborne germs Serratia marcescens and Bacillus gaglia, whatever that is. In 1953, CIA initiates Project MK Ultra. This is an 11-year research program designed to produce and test drugs and biological agents that would be used for mind control and behavior modification. Six of the subjects involved are sub-projects, I should say. Six of the sub-projects involved testing the agents on unwitting human beings. By 1955, the CIA, in an experiment to test its ability to infect human populations with biological agents, releases a bacteria withdrawn from the Army's biological warfare arsenal over Tampa Bay, Florida. By 1965, Project CIA and Department of Defense begin Project MK-Search, a program to develop a capability to manipulate human behavior through the use of mind-altering drugs. Now, the book that we're reviewing, called Mind Control, World Control, written by Jim Keith, has a large section in here on LSD and a number of other mind-altering drugs. But it leads us to the ultimate end use of this mind control. Can we control individuals? Can we control societies? Can we control groups of people? And the answer to all of that is yes, certainly. Psychological manipulation of people was the beginning back around the 1875 to 1925 or 30 period. Then it got down to, can we control groups of people, societies, nations? Can we use drugs to control groups of people, societies, and whole nations? And now we get down to, can we create cults? And can we use individuals out of those cults for specific mind-altered missions? And the answer to that is yes. Now, this isn't something that's new, that just developed in the Clinton administration or the last 20 or 30 years. It's something that's been going on for at least 125 years. It had a beginning, and it has an ultimate conclusion. R.D. Laing, L-A-I-N-G, author of the popular The Politics of Experience and an associate of the Tavistock Institute, probably knew what he was talking about when he stated in an interview in Omni magazine. He said, quote, "In the late 1960s, it became apparent to the elite with responsibilities for control of the population that the old idea of putting people in the proverbial bin and keeping them there for life, warehousing people, simply was no longer cost-effective. The Reagan administration in California was one of the first to realize this. So they had to rethink just what the name of the game was. That has led to a schism between what is said to the general public and what is practiced by the executive in control of mental health. And the same problem prevails across Europe and the Third World. To see what is happening today, just look at the textbook or manual called DSM-3. DSM-3. It's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Mental Disorders, 3rd edition, published by the American Psychiatric Association. Now, translated into economic and political terms, mental disorder means undesired mental states and behavior. The criteria for mental disorder in DSM-3 includes any unusual perceptual experience, magical thinking, clairvoyance, telepathy, sixth sense of a person not actually present. You're allowed to sense the presence of a dead relative for 3 weeks after his death. After that, it becomes a criteria for mental disorder to have those feelings. These are not exceptional examples out of DSM-3. The overall drift is that contemporary modern psychiatry, epitomized by the DSM manual translated into 18 languages now, is imposing over all of the world a mandate to strip anyone of their civil liberties, habeas corpus, and to apply involuntary incarceration, chemicalization of a person, electric shocks, and non-injurious torture, such as the taser, to homogenize people who are out of line. presented as a medical operation, it is an undercover operation. With increased scrutiny by Congress and the American people in the late 1970s, the CIA and other intelligence agencies moved their experimentation out of the laboratory and went underground. And one of their strategies for experimentation as well as social manipulation was in the creation of mind control cults, like Jim Jones. Now, I do not maintain that all of these off-the-wall mystical or religious groups practicing mental manipulation were formed or forced by intelligence agencies as test tubes for their projects. However, examining intelligence agencies as various groups, these solid connections to intelligence agencies are apparent in their own reports. The apparency is that many of these groups have been formed in this way, while others have been infiltrated and then influenced through manipulation. Here are a few examples. Remember Charles Manson's leering face, with or without that homemade swastika tattoo on his forehead? He's one of the defining images of the 1960s, and it is perhaps one of the changing images of man, presented by the media as a madman holding his small band of followers under his sway in the desert, sallying forth to murder the rich and the famous. There is much to suggest that this is not the whole of the story. Manson was released from a California prison in 1967, and under the stipulations of his parole, he reported to Roger Smith at the Haight-Ashbury Medical Clinic in San Francisco. Now, that's a facility sponsored by the National Institute for Mental Health. The Haight-Ashbury district itself was termed a human guinea pig farm by one CIA agent. Dr. Louis Joylin West, for one, was running a mysterious safe house in the Haight in the Summer of Love. While in prison, Manson was connected to the AMORC Rosicrucians, the same group that Sirhan Sirhan had ties to. Manson was also in touch with members of the Process and Apocalyptic Scientology spin-off group, and he dubbed his own group the Final Church, using Process terminology. In San Francisco, Manson lived at 636 Cole Street, while the Process group lived at number 407, close to the center of activity in the Haight-Ashbury district. Manson's reported plan to unleash the apocalyptic helter-skelter revolution also seems to have been copped straight from Process theology, but there is a familiar ring. The process of the process is identical to that of Travestock, the return of the blank slate, and tabula rasa, through violence. Now, David Berkowitz, convicted for the Son of Sam murders, later linked Manson to the Los Angeles-based wing of the satanic cult that he was a member of, reportedly termed the Children. Manson is also alleged to have been connected to Scientology, as well as to a coven in New Orleans whose members supposedly included Janis Joplin and the University of Texas tower sniper Charles Whitman. Manson's base of operation was at the Spawn Movie Ranch, later bought out by the owners of the ranch next door, the German Krupp family, who were key to the arming of the Third Reich. Manson, as well as alleged assassin Sirhan Sirhan, are reported to have attended drug orgies at the Polanski Tate Mansion. Actress Sharon Tate was the daughter of an Army intelligence officer, and her husband, Roman Polanski, directed the satanic-themed film Rosemary's Baby. Polanski later fled the United States after a statutory rape accusation, and British warlock Alex Sanders claims that he personally initiated Sharon Tate into witchcraft. Jay Sebring, another of the victims, according to Sammy Davis Jr.'s biography, Why Me?, had acted as a high priest at a satanic simulated sacrifice. Sebring had visited the Spawn Ranch in the company of a woman in a wig identified as Sharon. Now, Robert F. Kennedy is reported to have eaten dinner at the Polanski place the day before his assassination, a connection that may resonate with the Sirhan role in his murder. The Manson, or mansion, I should say, where the five murders were committed on August 9th, 1969, was at 10050 Celio Drive, and it was sublet by Roman Polanski from Terry Milcher, who was friends with Manson. 3 days before the murder, a drug dealer was publicly whipped at Celio, and according to actor Dennis Hopper, they had fallen into sadism and masochism and bestiality, and they recorded it all on videotape, as the L.A. police found those tapes and have those records. I know that 3 days before they were killed, 25 people were invited to that house for a mass whipping of a drug dealer from Sunset Strip who had given them bad dope. On August the 5th, shortly before the murders, Manson was at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Esalen, remarkably enough, is a New Age capital, assisted in its founding in 1962 by Aldous Huxley, and involved in sponsoring various kinds of meditational training and meditational speakers. Process founder Robert de Grimston is reported to have spoken at Esalen. One of the victims of the Tate murders was Abigail Folger, the coffee heiress. She had attended sessions at Esalen. And according to an Esalen newsletter, Esalen started in the fall of 1962 as a forum to bring together a wide variety of approaches to enchantment of the human potential, including experimental sessions involving encounter groups, sensory perception, sensory awakening, gestalt awareness training, and related disciplines. Our latest step is to fan out into the community at large, running programs in cooperation with many different institutions, churches, schools, hospitals, and government. In other words, societry, to use the terminology of another organization, the Travestock Institute. At the murder site itself, Tate was hung upside down in the image of the Hanged Man Tarot Card, a popular way for dispatching occult traitors. Were there puppeteers other than Charles Manson standing behind the Manson family murders? David Berkowitz, convicted for the Son of Sam killing, said that Manson volunteered to do the killings for someone else. One of the names that consistently comes up in investigations of the Manson family is The Process. But investigator Ed Sanders, who wrote a book on the Manson family, said, "There were so many investigations going on out there after the murders that I began to wonder if The Process was just a front for some intelligence operation." An ex-procession provides more solid information. You know, a lot of people say The Process is a fascist organization, and it's actually half true. It was founded by the German Democratic Party, a neo-Nazi group in Germany, as a front to raise money over here in the United States. But since that time, it's grown more or less independent of the German group. Now, I know a number of American Nazis and fascists who will not have anything to do with the process. They say they don't want to be part of a group that's run by Europeans. Now, an operation apparently sprung from the dragon's teeth of the CIA and the Louis Joyon West Violence Center project was the Symbionese Liberation Army. Colston Westbrook was a black CIA psychological warfare expert who had participated in Operation Phoenix in Vietnam and was a part of Pacific Engineering Company, a subsidiary of Pacific Corporation, reportedly the largest CIA cutout in the world. Time magazine at the time simplified things by abbreviating his credentials to being simply a linguist. Apparently based upon the job description, Westbrook got a job teaching black lexicon at the University of California in Berkeley, then whipped up what was called the Black Cultural Association at the infamous Vacaville Medical Facility, actually a prison in California. The program was organized by Donald DeFries, who had been a member of the Los Angeles Police Department's Public Disorder Unit between 1967 and 1969. Now, DeFries, according to research, and researcher Alex Constantine described his incarceration on the prison's third floor, where he was corralled by CIA agents who drugged him and said that he would become the leader of a radical movement and kidnap a wealthy person. After his escape from Vacaville, an exit door was left unlocked for him. That's exactly what he did. Westbrook reportedly gave DeFries the handle Sinki Matumi and worked up the Cobra logo for the SLA. The same logo was also used by alleged police agent Ron Coringa and his U.S. organization. After DeFries escaped from Vacaville, he ended up on the doorsteps of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and the Venceremos Brigade, offering his services as a hitman. This is a standard method of establishing an identity in underground cadres by stepping forth as the baddest of the bad. Joseph Romero and Nancy Ling Perry, members of the SLA, were political conservatives, according to researcher Mae Brussel, with a kill a commie for Christ background. Both were also drug addicts, a useful part of their profile. Bill and Emily Harris, also members, had no discernible background in radical politics, but came from the University of Indiana, a school used in the recruitment for the CIA. They had worked as a NARC team for the Indiana State Police. The majority of individuals linked to the SLA by the police, in fact, had no earlier connection to radical politics, although several had worked with Colston Westbrook and Donald DeFries at Vacaville. Now, on February the 4th, 1974, the SLA kidnapped Patricia Hearst. She's the heiress to the Hearst newspaper fortune. And she was reportedly brainwashed and recruited as a member of the group and was utilized in several very visible fundraising events held at banks. And she was arrested on September 18, 1975. During the period that Hearst was eluding the police, there were one or more Hearst doubles in action. Researcher John Judge said in an interview, quote, "There was a pickup of somebody who said that she wasn't Patty Hearst, but she looked exactly like her, and she had gone to school up in Cleveland. Now a cop picked her up, and she had a scar in the same place, and everything was identical, but she wasn't Patty Hearst." Then, An FBI agent supposedly came into the scene and said that if she ever got picked up again, all she had to do was tell them to call this FBI agent and he would clear her. So it was a perfect way for Patty to move in, and there was an accidental pickup, and if there was, they had created a phony double. Now, the media inflated stories of the SLA into what seemed to be the beginnings of a racial war, although it may have actually been planned that way. Then, the cavalry arrived. On May the 17th, 1974, the headquarters of the SLA in Los Angeles was surrounded by 150 Los Angeles Police Department officers, 100 FBI, 100 Sheriff's Department officers, 15 Highway Patrolmen, and 25 motorcycle officers providing traffic control. The police flamed the place with 6 SLA members killed. After the burning of the SLA headquarters, the CIA-funded psychiatrist Martin Orne, Louis Joylin West, and Robert J. Lifton provided psychological pretrial examinations of Patty Hearst. Another psychiatrist called upon to testify in the Hearst trial was Margaret Singer, who had studied returned Korean War prisoners at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland, worked with West at his Hashbury safe house, and who provided a book blurb on Raven by Tim Ritterman and John Jacobs, and a report on the Jim Jones People's Temple that conveniently overlooked information linking that group to the CIA. Now, Orne and Singer later turned up as directors of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, a group whose board is primarily made up of CIA and military doctors. The purpose of the group is to disprove claims of cult mind control. That's important. The purpose of this CIA group is to disprove any claims of mind control by any of these cult groups who might claim, well, gee, we're the victims of mind control. Now, here's Hearst's account of what happened after her arrest. When the first of the psychiatrists came to see me, this is Patty Hearst, on September 30th, just 11 days after my arrest, I simply crumbled under his scrutiny. I cried, murmuring and mumbling out replies that were not answers to his questions. He thought I was refusing to cooperate with him. This was Dr. Louis Joylin West, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA, director of the Neuropsychiatric Institute, psychiatrist-in-chief of the UCLA hospitals. He's a licensed MD, chairman of the Council on Research and Development of the American Psychiatric Association, psychiatric consultant to the Air Force, author of books and studies on prisoners of war, and internationally recognized expert in his field. I thought he had a creepy, hypnotic voice, a tall, heavy-set man who appeared to be kindly. I suspected Jolly of being too smooth, too soothing, to be trusted. Now, that was Patty Hearst. That was her evaluation of the psychiatrist that interviewed her. All right, there's more of the intrigue to come. We'll have to take a break here, and we'll come back, and we'll take a look a little further into the cult connection with the CIA and intelligence operators and operations using mind control. Can it really be true that human beings can be hypnotized, drugged, and mind controlled? That was an old technique that went clear back into the 1930s. If it could be done in the 30s, as we've already seen in this series of programs, can it be done today? We'll stand by for more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the psychological manipulations of people called mind control. Mind Control, World Control, written by Jim Keith, is available at Barnes & Noble. Well, another of the shrinks to examine Patty Hearst after her capture was Dr. Martin Orne. He was a CIA Navy doctor involved during the 1960s in mind control experiments underwritten by the Human Ecology Fund and the Scientific Engineering Institute, both CIA fronts. And at one point, Orne boasted that he received routine briefing on all CIA behavioral modification experiments. Orne is also one of the original members of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, a group of psychiatrists, many of them with backgrounds linked to the CIA, whose mission is to prove that cult mind control and ritual child abuse does not exist. The soundtrack for the 60s is, of course, provided by the Grateful Dead, LSD, and Rock and Roll Organization. Until the death of leader Jerry Garcia, the Dead were arguably the most influential cult in operation. The first member of the Grateful Dead to take LSD, Robert Hunter, did so under the auspices of a government-sponsored Stanford University drug study. An FBI internal memo from 1968 also mentions the employment of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead as an avenue to channel youth dissent and rebellion into more benign and non-threatening directions. It is obvious that with their laid-back, non-politically involved stance, that the Grateful Dead have performed a vital service in distracting many young persons into drugs and mysticism rather than politics. Whether they knew they were performing the service is a matter for argument. Now, another repository of deadheads was Jonestown, the despotic community established by evangelist Jim Jones in Guyana, South America. Most of us are familiar with the tragedy where nearly 1,000 members of the People's Temple are reported to have committed suicide there by drinking cyanide on the orders of Jones. But there is more to this apparent mass suicide than meets the eye in this triangle. Jonestown, without a doubt, was an MK Ultra project. Suspicious associations of Jim Jones go back many years to the man's boyhood and his lifelong friendship with Dan Mitterrone. Mitterrone trained in the CIA-financed International Police Academy. He may have been the source of Jones' unexplained funding when in 1961 Jones traveled to Brazil. Mitterrone, working closely with the CIA at that point, accompanied him, and at the time, Jones explained to his Brazilian neighbors that he was employed by Navy intelligence, and both his food and a large house he and his small group lived in were provided by the U.S. Embassy. According to a local resident, Jones lived like a king, and at the time, Jones was making regular trips to Belo Horizonte, the headquarters of the CIA in Brazil. In 1963, Jones returned to the United States with an unexplained windfall of $10,000, sufficient to launch his next operation. In Ukiah, California, Jones established the First People's Temple. The Happy Havens Rest Home was also set up in the same location, guarded by electric fences, guard towers, dogs, and armed guards, all dressed in black. Anyone attempting to leave the compound were sometimes forcibly restrained. There were at least 150 foster children living at the camp, along with elderly persons, prisoners, and psychiatric patients. At that time, the People's Temple linked up with the Mendocino State Mental Hospital, and members of the group were trained in medical techniques there. And it's reported that in a short while, the entire staff of the mental hospital were members of Jones People's Temple. California virtually handed the Mendocino State Mental Hospital to Jim Jones on a silver platter. And according to researcher Michael Myers, the Mendocino Plan was a pilot program of the federal government designed to evaluate the feasibility of deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill. Dennis Denny, Mendocino's Director of Social Services, has speculated that the Mendocino Plan was the sole reason that Jim Jones moved to Ukiah. And during the period that Jones was in Ukiah, Jones' group conducted behavior modification experiments on both the patients in the mental hospital and on Jones' congregation. Jones used sensory deprivation on some of his congregation during this period, and it is said that Jones' expertise in the technique was passed on to Donald DeFries of the Symbionese Liberation Army, who would later use the method on Patty Hearst. In Ukiah, Jones is reported to have been in touch with CIA-connected World Vision, an evangelical anti-communist church union that includes far-right church groups like Carl McIntyre's International Council of Christian Churches. World Vision is said to have employed Mark David Chapman, the murderer of John Lennon. John Hinckley Sr., the father of the man who shot Ronald Reagan, is a friend of Reagan's Vice President George Bush, significant for the possible motive, and ran a World Vision mission in Denver, Colorado. Another of Hinckley Sr.'s sons was to have dinner with Neil Bush on the day of the attempted assassination. Hinckley Jr. was a prime candidate for mind control assassination programming. He was the recipient of mood-altering drugs from his hometown psychiatrist and was on Valium when he shot President Reagan. His double, a man named Richardson, who followed Hinckley in Colorado and wrote love letters to Jodie Foster, was a follower of Carl McIntyre. Hinckley also claimed to have met with David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Murderer, while in Colorado. In Ukiah, Jim Jones hobnobbed with all of the pillars of the community, and he allied himself with Walter Heady, the leader of the local John Birch Society. Members of the People's Temple organized voting drives for Richard Nixon, worked with the Republican Party, and Jones was appointed chairman of the county grand jury. A number of persons who would soon be influential in the People's Temple joined the group in Ukiah, and according to researcher John Judge, most of the top lieutenants around Jones were from wealthy, educated backgrounds, many with connections to the military or intelligence agencies. And these were the people who would set up the bank accounts, the complex legal actions, and financial records that put people under the People's Temple control. Now, among the most important of Jones' known supporters, who knows what scoundrels might have been lurking behind the scenes, were the aristocratic Layton family, who financed Jones with large sums of money and were related to wealthy British and German families. Dr. Lawrence Layton was chief of chemical and ecological warfare research at the infamous Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah. Working later at the Navy Propellant Division as director of missile and satellite development. Layton's stockbroker, father-in-law, represented the German I.G. Farben monolith, which is owned principally by Queen Elizabeth. The parents of George Philip Blakely, the husband of the former Debbie Layton, also had large holdings in Solvay Drugs, a division of I.G. Farben, and Blakely is reported to have been a CIA operative and to have run mercenaries out of Jonestown, supplying forces to the CIA-backed UNITA in Angola. Blakely is reported to have made the original $650,000 deposit on the land in Guyana that was to become Jonestown. Another prominent alleged member of the People's Temple was Timothy Stone, S-T-O-E-N, the Assistant District Attorney of San Francisco. Jones utilized his people to organize a voting drive for Mayor Moscone and was rewarded by being put in charge of the San Francisco Housing Commission, a fact never mentioned in the mainstream press. Many of Jones' followers obtained jobs at the City Welfare Department and were able to use those positions to gain recruits for the People's Temple. Seven mysterious deaths connected to the People's Temple were reported in the local press, and increased scrutiny by the media and politicians apparently led Jones to pull up stakes and move his operation to Guyana. Guyana was not Jones' initial choice as a site for relocation. He had earlier decided on Grenada and deposited $200,000 in the Grenada National Bank in 1977. After the Jonestown massacre, $76,000 remained in that bank. The Jonestown location is a rich source of minerals and had earlier been the site of a Union Carbide, bauxite, and manganese mine. There had been earlier plans to bring in large numbers of workers to the area, going back as far as 1919. In current years, the area has been repopulated by about 100,000 Laotian Hmong people. After the Guyanese location for the People's Temple was decided upon, it was prepared for habitation by members with the cooperation of local officials and the U.S. Embassy. The Information Services Company states that the U.S. Embassy in Georgetown, Guyana, housed the Georgetown CIA station, and it now appears that the majority and perhaps all of the embassy officials were CIA officers operating under State Department covers. And among embassy officials verified as being agents of the CIA are U.S. Ambassador John Burke, who attempted to stop Congressman Leo Ryan's investigation of Jonestown; Dan Weber, who was at the site of the massacre the following day; and Chief Consular Officer Richard McCoy, on loan from the Defense Department and reportedly very close to Jones. Oh, we got to take another break here, so hang on, and we'll take a look at this thing of cult control, the psychological manipulation of people, groups, societies, and nations through the use of drugs and cults, which is now down to control of individuals. All right. Hang on for a second and we'll take a break. You gotta wait until the clock gets up here to the right moment and then we'll take our break, which is right now. Stand by. All right. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history, and surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us, and a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business and industry obtains all of this information about you? Would you like to know what their sources are? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? And what do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call me here at the law school, 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. Just call 417-273-4967 to order yours. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, what is a cult anyway? Before we go any further here, talking about Jim Jones, the CIA, and cults, and LSD, and the connections with government intelligence agencies with these cults, how would we know what a cult is? What do they look like? Where do you find them in the Yellow Pages? Well, here are 8 cult identifiers that are set out by our government. Our government tells us what we should be looking for. So, if you can't trust your government, who can you trust? So listen to this. Religious organizations, government agencies, and cult awareness groups have divided religious groups into 3 types. Number 1 is churches or denominations. Second, sects. And third, cults. Now, the major difference between these 3 is membership, acceptance in the dominant culture, and the length of time that the organization has existed. So, the Catholic Church, the Mormons, and the Lutherans are examples of churches or denominations. These are the major players in the religious arena today, and many of what today are considered denominations were just the legitimized descendants of sects a few decades or centuries ago. Now, sects are defined as splinter groups that split off from these differing churches and or denominations. And they have various philosophical and or organizational differences from the mainstream that they broke away from. So, many Pentecostal groups fit into this category, as do the small, non-affiliated Neo-Baptist churches in rural America. Now, cults are at the bottom of the heap. These are groups that are so small and or so radical that they cannot be given the legitimacy of sect status, or large groups that are almost nothing more than a cult of personality devoted to a specific individual. And all of these major churches, denominations, and sects started out with cult status when they were founded. So Jesus Christ of Nazareth was a cult leader, a charismatic leader of 12 disciples that later developed into what we call Christianity today. Isn't that surprising? Jesus Christ was a cultist, a cult leader. Well, this definition of cult, however, has been recently expanded from the purely religious to the semi-secular. While most cults do have a mystic tradition, the cult that is purely religious is not so much in the news these days as are the new style cults. There are a number of traits that have been passed down by these various cult awareness groups to identify these new style cults. All right, number one. Here's what you're looking for when you're looking at a cult. Number one, there's usually one supreme leader, and when there isn't, the vast majority of the time, it's a husband and wife shared leadership. All right? Number two, the supreme leader is highly charismatic. Number three, the supreme leader and his way are presented as the only answer to his followers' problems. Number four, the cult controls or attempts to control all aspects of its followers' lives. Number five, the cult usually discourages any and all family contacts and or ties unless said family members are also members of the cult. Number six, the cult is usually isolationistic. This can be physical isolation or simple social isolation. Number seven, the cult is usually destructive, and this can be physically destructive, as in various guerrilla movements, or socially destructive, as in groups that attempt to destroy the social fabric of any organized or semi-organized resistance to their ideas, and or personally destructive, as in the Scientologists' efforts to destroy the lives of anybody who crosses them by lawsuits or frame-ups. Any given cult may use any or all of these tactics to prevent its followers from straying and to forestall any interference in its appointed mission. And number eight, the cult usually conceals or attempts to conceal its true nature from both outsiders and all but the leadership in the cult. A cult's true purpose is the personal aggrandizement of the supreme leader, whether it be in terms of power, wealth, sex, etc., and the cult is there to fulfill all of the wishes of the supreme leader. All right? Now, not all new style cults will have all of these traits, which is why they're said to usually have a certain trait. However, the presence of six of these traits will usually result in the tag of cult being thrown on a group. Now, all the news media has to have is three or four of these traits from one of these non-accepted church denominations or sects. And the news media will then throw out the tag of cult, and this can be very misleading, as most sports teams and elite military units have all of the traits of numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. All right, now let's run back and let's run through these eight traits and apply them to the United States of America and our political establishment. For instance, number one, there is usually one supreme leader, Bill Clinton and Hillary, or George Bush and Laura. When there isn't, the vast majority of the time, it's a husband and wife shared leadership, as we saw with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. Number two, the supreme leader is highly charismatic, such as Bill Clinton or George Bush. Number three, the supreme leader and his way are presented as the only answer to his followers' problems. And in America, we have Republican and Democratic parties. John Kerry proposes that the Democratic Party and John Kerry is the only solution to our nation's problems. And George Bush and the Republican Party espouse that they are the only solution to our nation's problems. Number four, the cult controls or attempts to control all aspects of its followers' lives. So when we look at politics in the United States, we find OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, the IRS, Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, all of these forms of legislation and bureaucratic institutions are there to minutely control and direct the followers of the United States of America and their lives. And number six, the cult is usually isolistic, and this can be physical isolation or simply social isolation. Well, if you think about it, citizens of the United States are isolated in the United States. Very few people in the United States ever leave this country and go to Mexico or Brazil or Africa, Asia. Some do, but they're usually the aristocracy. They're the moneyed classes, not Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. I left out number five. Number five, the cult usually discourages any and all family contacts and or ties unless the said family members are also members of the cult. Well, all Americans are members of the cult of the United States of America. You're all citizens. And all of the citizens are encouraged to hold the flag of the United States and worship, of course, our idol, the Statue of Liberty, and sing our national anthem. The cult discourages any and all family contacts and or ties unless said family members are also members of the cult. And we're out here today watching everybody. Are you really a loyal member of our cult, or are you a traitor? Are you one of those ragheads? Number seven, the cult is usually destructive. And this can be physically destructive, as in various guerrilla movements, or socially destructive, as in groups that attempt to destroy the social fabric of any organized or semi-organized resistance to their ideas. Isn't that the United States of America attacking Iraq? Think about it. The cult is destructive. The United States of America has intervened in the foreign affairs of 84 nations over the past 224 years. I mean, the United States is the most interventionist country on planet Earth. We have attacked Mexico three times during the Woodrow Wilson administration. Between 1912 and 1920, we attacked Mexico, our southern neighbor, three times. We have been involved in interventions all over the world. Vietnam, China, Russia, and now Iraq, Afghanistan. And we're very destructive. And these people are opposed to our ideas of democracy. And we can be very destructive in these various movements that we promote. And then finally, the cult usually conceals or attempts to conceal its true nature from both outsiders and all but the leadership in the cult. A cult's true purpose is the personal aggrandizement of the supreme leader, George Bush, the war president, protecting us, the members of the cult, from these terrorists who are going to attack us. And you report any suspicious activities that you see going on. So as a cult member, if I see any of you people out there acting suspiciously, I'm going to call my Homeland Security block warden and report you. Yeah, the United States of America, Germany, France, Britain, all the nations of the world are nothing more than cults following their supreme leaders. Oh, well, so much for reality, huh? There's your reality check for the day. All right, we're going to have to cut it off right here. I'm out of time. So you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We'll have to leave it right there until tomorrow, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.